Venerable sir and friends, I think the statement which I am going to make to begin with will not be disputed by anybody, at least I hope not. And that is the statement that everybody dreams. That is what the psychologists, that is what the psychoanalysts tell us, that everybody, each and every one of us, dreams every night. They say some 4 or 5 times. We're even told that animals dream, as we can sometimes see in the case of our own pets. So let's start with this statement, that everybody dreams. And we can go a little further than this, I think, and say that not only does everybody dream when they're asleep at night, but also, we may say, everybody daydreams. You all know how it is when it's a nice, warm, sunny afternoon. Maybe you're sitting on a park bench. It's all very cozy, very comfortable, you're quiet, and you just start daydreaming. This is something which everybody does at some time or other. And of course, the daydream is usually a sort of wish fulfillment, a sort of Walter Mitty exercise. You dream of all the things you'd like to do and the things that you'd like to be. Because the reason for this is that only too often we find that our everyday life, our everyday existence, is very dull, is very drab, colourless, uninteresting, unsatisfactory, and so on. We may have a tiresome and monotonous job. We may be in circumstances which we dislike. We may be having to associate with people with whom we're not particularly friendly, and so on. And it may even be that we find life not only dull, not only uninteresting, not only monotonous, we may even find it positively painful. So we want to get away from it. We try to create a world of our own outside ordinary existence, and therefore we start, as it were, daydreaming in various ways. We start imagining a better state of affairs. We start, as it were, dreaming up some ideal world, or even an ideal society, ideal community, in which the imperfections of this world and this society do not exist. Here there's misery, here there's unhappiness, but we like to think, or we like to imagine, we like to daydream about some other place, some other world, where everybody is happy, and where, no doubt, we can be happy too. Now, we may say that daydreaming of this sort is not altogether a bad thing. Provided, of course, we don't indulge in it too often, or when we ought really to be doing something else. It's true that most daydreaming is what we may describe as unproductive fantasy, but on the other hand, we can also say, we can also even assert, that daydreams are very often, or at least sometimes, at least occasionally, blueprints of the future. We may even say that today's dream, in some cases, may be tomorrow's reality. And if we look at the history of the world, at the history of culture, history of religions, history of the arts, history of philosophy, we very often find that the greatest men of the past, the greatest men and the greatest women too, are sometimes, or have sometimes been, the greatest dreamers. If we go back to the days of ancient Greece, if we think, say, of someone like Plato, surely one of the greatest men who have ever lived, we find that Plato too dreamed his dreams. And the greatest of his dreams, the most famous of his dreams, is of course the Republic, that great classic, that great dialogue in 12 books, where Plato dreams his dream of the ideal society, the Republic, a society based upon truth and upon justice. In the same way, if we come to other traditions, other cultures, other classics, we find similarly, say, the dream or the vision of the Bible, the last book of the Bible, that is to say, the book of Revelations, where we have this wonderful, even this marvelous vision of the New Jerusalem with its walls made of precious and semi-precious stones and all the rest of it, with a great mystical and sort of archetypal significance. And so it is down the ages, we may say. They're coming nearer to our own times. There's Sir Thomas More's Utopia, Bacon's New Atlantis, Campanella's A City of the Sun, and so on, right down to our own days, with Mr. H.G. Wells's Men Like Gods, and so on. So all of these, whether it's Plato's Republic or More's Utopia, and so on, these are all, as it were, daydreams of these great thinkers, these great dreamers, daydreams of an ideal society, daydreams of a world transfigured and transformed. So going even farther afield, going to the east, turning to Buddhism, we may say that Buddhism too has its daydreams. Buddhism's daydream of the ideal society is found, we may say, in its conception, its vision of the Pure Land, or the Happy Land, described in some of the great Mahayana sutras. The Pure Land, or the Happy Land, especially as taught by the Shin schools of Japanese Buddhism, is a place, a world, a sphere, if you like, a plane of existence, where there is no pain, where there is no suffering, where there's no misery, no separation, no bereavement, no loss of any kind. It's a place where there is no old age, where there's no sickness, and where above all there is no death. A place of perfect peace, a place where there's no conflict, no war, no battle, not even any misunderstanding. It's as perfect and as happy as that. And also these great Mahayana sutras tell us the Pure Land or the Happy Land is a place where there is no distinction of sex, no distinction of male and female, where also no one has to do any work, where it's a lifetime of perpetual leisure, and no one has to toil, and no one has to go to the office every morning, and so on. The food and clothing just appear of their own accord, even better than the welfare state. The food comes dropping down from trees, and clothes just appear miraculously upon you whenever and wherever you need them. No one has anything to do in the Pure Land or the Happy Land except to sit on his, well, I shouldn't really say his, but I can't very well say its, golden or purple or blue lotus, and just sit at the feet of the Buddha and just learn about, just study Buddhism. In the Happy Land, in the Pure Land, we are told, no one has anything to do except just this. And of course, to crown it all, especially from our English point of view, we may add, we're told that in the Pure Land, in the Happy Land, the weather is always perfect. So this is Buddhism's dream, or Buddhism's daydream, or if you like, its vision of an ideal society and an ideal world. But you may, of course, be feeling, you may be thinking, that this is all rather remote. This is all rather ideal. This is all rather archetypal. This is all rather mythological. It doesn't concern us very much. But we should also remember that though, upon occasion, Buddhism does dream, and dream very beautifully, it isn't content merely to dream. We may say that on the whole, the approach of Buddhism, of the Buddha's teaching to all these questions, is very sane, is very practical, is also realistic. So Buddhism isn't content to dream about the ideal society of the future, or about some ideal world on some other plane. It tries to create also the ideal society, the ideal community, if you like, here and now on this earth. It tries, therefore, to transform. It tries to transfigure this society and this world into the image of the future, into the image of the ideal. And it does this in a number of different ways. And one of the ways in which it does this, one of the ways in which it tries to transform, to transfigure this world and this society, is with the help of its teaching of what we call a right livelihood. Now, right livelihood is the fifth step of the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. And as most of you know, especially those who have been coming here faithfully week by week, we are at present in this course of talks studying this very path, the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. And every week, of course, we're directing our attention to one step or one stage or one aspect of that great path. Now, before proceeding with the present stage, the stage of right livelihood, let us just try to see, let us just try to understand this step or this stage in the context of the total path. And of course, for those who have been following week by week, this should be quite easy, or at least not very difficult. You'll remember, of course, that the first stage, which is the stage of perfect vision, consists in a sort of initial insight into the nature of existence, seeing a little deeper than people usually see, seeing a little further, seeing more truly, having at least a glimpse, a vision of reality. This is not just an intellectual understanding, this perfect vision, but primarily a sort of spiritual experience. And this first step or first stage of perfect vision by itself, just this one step or one stage, constitutes what we also call the path of vision, the first of the two great sections in which the whole Eightfold Path is divided. Now, perfect vision then, as it were, descends into and transforms different aspects of our being. That is to say, we have this vision, we have this glimpse of reality, and this alters our whole outlook, our whole way of seeing things, our whole way of doing things. And this altered outlook gradually communicates itself to different aspects of our being, so that little by little, aspect by aspect, we are gradually transformed from top to bottom. And this process of transformation is represented by all the remaining seven stages of the path, which are collectively known as the path of transformation. So path of vision, consisting of the first step only, path of transformation, consisting of all the rest. The second step, or the second stage of the Eightfold Path, which is perfect emotion, represents the transformation of our entire emotional life. Perfect speech, the third stage, represents the transformation of our communication with one another. And perfect action, the fourth stage, represents the transformation of our ordinary everyday behavior.